Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Andrea and Ron DeFeo, Dr. Robert Peskin, and Dr. Raymond Ellis. California faces serious risk of earthquakes. Tall buildings present a special case of vulnerable structures because of the challenges of exterior access and the risk exposure of many tenants, users, and nearby non-occupants. Such structures are becoming a dominant part of the downtown San Francisco business and residential infrastructure. And recently, the City of San Francisco's Department of Emergency Management completed a study of tall buildings that focused on damage minimization and rapid restoration of functionality. Talking with us today about this study is Brian Strong, who is San Francisco's Chief Resilience Officer and Director of its Office of Resilience and Capital Planning, the office that oversaw this study. Thanks for spending some time with us this morning, Brian.
You're welcome, Joe. I'm, as someone who's been working in the field of infrastructure for 15 years, I'm excited to be part of your show.
Very good. I'm glad you're with us. First, tell us something about your office. What's the function of your office?
Yeah, so our office was originally created to develop and implement the city's 10-year capital plan. Largely, the focus of our office for the first 10 years or so was putting together what's now a $39 billion 10-year capital plan and figuring out how we're going to fund the various infrastructure improvements and programs within that document. And the office also extends to doing the city's annual budget process for capital. A couple years ago, we expanded to include the Office of Resilience. So now I'm the Chief Resilience Officer, and that's involved us looking at infrastructure issues outside of the Office of Capital Planning. So now we're working quite a bit with infrastructure that's owned by the private sector and how we can work within city codes and rules and then work closely with folks, with building owners, community organizations, and so forth to improve privately owned infrastructure.
So that brings you to the tall building study. Can you tell us what the purpose of that is, the purpose and scope?
Yeah, so the tall building study is really sort of an offshoot of a number of years of studies that we've been doing. We had a community action plan for seismic safety that was published in 2011, and it had a sort of 30-year roadmap of different things the city should be doing to improve the seismic performance of its buildings and to ensure that we're better able to respond to and recover from a major earthquake, which is the largest hazard that the city and county of San Francisco faces. And having experienced the 1906 earthquake and the massive fires that occurred after it, earthquakes have been on the mind of San Franciscans pretty much ever since. So some of the recommendations in there, we're talking about building performance. Over the past 5 years or so, we've seen our downtown beginning to change, and now we're seeing a downtown where it's no longer just commercial high-rises, but now we're also seeing a lot of residential high-rises. In addition, we have seen some buildings where we're seeing settlement happen or we're seeing some tilting, so to say, and that's also raised some concerns that people have. And when we start to think about building performance, we started to recognize that downtown, we need to treat it differently. They're complex buildings. They affect hundreds of thousands of people that are working there, but now that are also living there. And the effect of one building goes beyond its footprint. It also affects the surrounding areas. There are cordoning issues and so forth. And unlike single-family homes, the strategies and how we get people safely out of their homes or out of these buildings after an earthquake is important, but also how we can get people back into their homes or back into these buildings and get businesses back up and running, which we know is the key to a successful recovery.
One of the things I saw in the study was some recommendations related to what you call the Building Occupancy Restoration Program, BORP. What is that program and what are the recommendations?
Yeah, it's the BORP program is what we refer to it.
I love the name.
And it's a program that we put in place after the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, and it really is unique around the country and, in fact, around the world. What it does is it allows building owners to bring on engineers and other folks to evaluate a building before an event happens, basically to look at the different features of the building, to understand how it might perform, to sort of put together drawings and so forth. And then after an earthquake, we have these pre-certified engineers that can go in and they can evaluate and they can determine whether the building should be yellow tagged or red tagged or green tagged, meaning that they can quickly determine whether or not it can be occupiable and what issues need to be addressed if it can't be occupiable quickly. And the really important feature of this, and as this sort of tall building study showed, is that by doing this work up front and by being able to get in and do these building inspections right away, we can reduce by 20-30% the amount of time that it will take to get the building back up and running after an earthquake.
I sense in looking at the report that there is a kind of an overall theme that focuses on getting back to business or getting back to residences.
That's right. That is the primary objective here, and it's a lot of what our sort of resilient San Francisco strategy is about. We've seen what happened after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans and the struggles that they faced, and then when you speak about a downtown, we saw what happened in Christchurch, where their downtown after their earthquake and then the aftershock from the earthquake shuttered the downtown for well over 2 years. In San Francisco, you know, our downtown is not just the economic driver of the city, but also of the entire region. So it plays such a vital role that we knew that we had to look at this area of the city a little differently than other parts of San Francisco. And that was part of the sort of driving force behind marshaling the resources to do the work.
Focus on tall buildings is interesting. It's not something that sitting in the Midwest I would think about for San Francisco, but as I understand it, there's really been a proliferation of tall buildings in the central area in the last two decades, hasn't there not?
Yes, yeah, that's true. We've always had tall buildings to some extent, though also how you define them has changed. So our study focuses on buildings that are 240 feet or higher, but a lot of the issues that we're looking at for tall buildings also apply to some of the buildings that are 75 feet or higher. You know, it's part of, I think, we're seeing that cities are growing more and more all around the world. We're trying to reduce urban sprawl in places like California and so forth, where people are having to drive long commutes and so forth. So for a variety of reasons, everything ranging from quality of life to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we're growing our downtowns, and we do believe that that's the best thing for the environment, but it does raise other issues around making sure that we have safe infrastructure and that people can live in tight spaces.
The study also addresses changing the triggers for seismic upgrades, and if I recall correctly, a number of the other criteria for preparing or responding. So what's the reason for that? What is that informed by?
Yeah, you know, triggers are an important tool for how we can take care of our existing building stock and be sure it's upgraded. So every 3 years, San Francisco goes through, the whole state of California has code updates. And being an earthquake country like we are, we've seen dramatic changes in the code after some of the big earthquakes, the San Fernando earthquake or the Northridge earthquake, where the codes change and can change dramatically. We've been learning quite a bit over the years. And that means that we have existing buildings that were constructed sometimes as far back as the 1920s and 1930s that didn't have the benefit of that knowledge. So we have these triggers that enable us when you're doing a major renovation of a building or when you may see some type of damage that was unexpected in a smaller earthquake that allows us to use the building code to go to the owners and say, you know, we want you to evaluate your building or we want you to do a retrofit or to repair something, with the expectation that when there's a larger earthquake, that building will be that much safer.
When you started out this conversation, you mentioned something that strikes me as being really very important, and that is that your focus has shifted over the years from the public infrastructure to privately owned infrastructure. So how does that relationship work? Is it a matter of code enforcement or collaboration to get the private owners to do what the community thinks is best?
Yeah, I think it's a variety of approaches to do that. And I wouldn't necessarily suggest that our public infrastructure is more important than the private infrastructure, but we have control over it as a city. And it's important for us to sort of set the example for the private sector. And it would be unreasonable for us to say, hey, private sector, we expect you to build your structures to this performance where the city wasn't doing the same, or that we expect you to go back and retrofit your buildings if we're not taking the lead or leading by example. So that's an important role for us, and I think we look at sort of doing things in a couple different ways. One is leading by example and encouraging private owners to do that, and that can be anything from rating systems to showing the performance levels that we're doing for our buildings. And then we have some other programs where we're talking about just increasing transparency. And a lot of this report is about just collecting detailed data on 156 buildings that range in age from close to 100 years old to 1 or 2 years old was no small feat. That was probably the lion's share of the work here. And having that data available to people just in and of itself encourages building owners and the private sector folks to realize what they have and to want to take care of it and be able to show that they are being conscientious and making sure that their buildings are safe. And then the other way that we're doing it, and I think this is more of a last resort, but in certain situations it's appropriate, is when we have sort of mandatory code changes or requirements. And we are thinking about doing some of that, even related to the study, especially around some of the tall buildings where we know there could be vulnerabilities, or some of the new tall buildings that are coming up where we want to say, hey, we want you to go to a performance standard that's beyond just the code. We want to make sure that these buildings aren't just about life safety and getting people out safe, but they're about getting people back in and enable people, you know, after big earthquakes to be able to not lose all of their property, to be able to get on with their lives and move forward.
I can see that there's a real incentive on the part of the building owner to do the best, but then there's a trade-off against cost. In effect, spending short-term costs against long-term benefits that may be hard for some owners to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We recognize that. We've been moving forward with, for instance, our soft story program now. It's toward the end of its life cycle. We put that in place in 2013, and it's going to retrofit close to 6,000 buildings. And it's always a trade-off. There's always some tough decisions that have to be made about how much can I invest in my building. What are the risks? What are the probabilities that I have to face as a building owner? And so we're looking at ways to, again, encourage them. And where we can, try to provide some financing programs, if that can be helpful, or other incentives, enabling them to add additional units, for instance, to a building if they agree to do the retrofits. Those are the types of things that I think we'll continue to have to do because, as you may have heard, maybe similar to Chicago, the cost of housing and of construction in San Francisco, cost of land is extremely high, and we don't want to just become a city where only the wealthiest people can live.
Yes, I understand it's a particular issue in San Francisco, but I think it's true in all the large cities in the United States. Is there any way that I, for example, as a renter, can know something about the resilience of the structure that I'm considering renting in?
Well, that's part of the recommendations that we have in there, is to make it easier for people to understand the performance of their buildings and to sort of be able to communicate that information. As a renter, certainly if you're looking to move in a tall building in San Francisco, all the information that we have in this report is publicly available. So you actually could go in and look at the tall building database, which is online, our DataSF site, and you'd be able to actually learn quite a bit about the building that you're moving into.
So the database exists. I mean, it's discussed in the report, but as you're describing it, it's real and online right now.
That's right.
And what's in it? What can I find in that?
Well, in the database, you can find certainly the age of the building, the construction type, if we have any information on when it was last retrofitted, obviously the number of stories that are in the building. That type of information is all there.
And that was collected from the owners?
Yeah, that was actually collected mostly by going into our Department of Building Inspection and going through all the old files that we have when buildings received a permit, or some of the original drawings when the building was constructed.
So administrative data that were already on hand.
That's right.
Yeah.
Administrative data that's on hand, that's been collected, again, we're talking about buildings that have a wide range of age. So it's information that was collected, but it's not collected in one place, it's sort of dispersed within the files there. So you would have to sort of look at some drawings to be able to determine if it's a concrete building and then what kind of concrete building it is. And of course, knowing that tells you something about its seismic performance. It's information that's there, but it requires actual engineers, or we used graduate students and so forth, to be able to go in and sort of decipher it and put it into this database. One of the efforts going forward is, and our recommendation is, to expand the database to go all the way down to buildings that are 75 feet or higher, which means we'll have around 400 plus buildings in the database that people, again, can have access to and can look up their structures.
When I first looked at that, my reaction was, well, it sounds very mundane, but it strikes me that it's really high value, not only in advance of a seismic event, but after to know what you've got out there in terms of the characteristics of individual buildings.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's certainly what our disaster preparedness people call important situational awareness information. So we know where some of the more vulnerable buildings may be. And then it also has big applicability, you know, right afterwards as far as which buildings do we need to inspect, which buildings do we need to think about. When we talk about long-term recovery, it may also mean trying to move in the direction where we may change buildings, we may change where we build things. And it may be that we make some decisions based on this information after an earthquake, that maybe that's not where we want to have a tall building, or maybe a tall building in that area needs to have a different type of foundation. And if we can make those sort of determinations before the earthquake, then that really helps with recovery. Then there isn't a lot of sort of fighting and disputes over what should this building look like after an earthquake, or what should this neighborhood look like? Should we continue to have tall buildings here, or should we do something else? It's much easier to have those discussions before the event happens than after the event happens. And it also makes for moving into that recovery phase much easier.
So you're in a position to have some objective criteria for making land use and building code decisions.
That's right.
Yeah, and that seems really important.
And setting the expectations, you know, early so that people know that, okay, if this happens, this is the expectation.
Yeah. But it strikes me that it's an interesting balance here because of the emphasis you're putting on this BORP program, which is get back to business quickly. So it's not just a matter of being super conservative. It's a matter of kind of keeping your eye on the prize going forward.
Right. Yeah, right. Absolutely. And, you know, we've seen that BORP program. I think we have close to 200 buildings or so in it. And the vast majority of those are privately owned buildings with companies that want to get back up and running right away. And they recognize the benefits. Building owners and companies that recognize the benefits of doing this in advance and not being dependent on our Department of Building Inspections or others to sort of come and be able to tell them that their buildings are safe, but being able to sort of take a leadership role and take some control over getting their buildings cleared and up and running as fast as possible.
So it puts some of the knowledge and responsibility in their hands.
Right.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. So what's next? Where are you in terms of implementation of the results of this report?
Yeah, so the report came out really in January, and the study was published in January. And later that same month, the mayor actually issued an executive directive. So she identified four or five or so of the recommendations that she thinks are important to move forward with right away. And some of those are, they range from making sure that we're looking at the sort of geotechnical issues with the buildings and getting them into our codes as soon as possible. And then others of them are around our sort of emergency, what we call our ability for us to get sort of mutual aid and have people come and inspect buildings right away after an earthquake. And then the other one is really about developing a recovery plan for downtown and thinking about how this tall building sort of leads us in that direction of having a downtown recovery plan. So those are the main elements. Those we're working on right now. And then we also expect that we're going to be making changes. We do have what we call our triannual code update is happening, and we're going to be working in some of the changes recommended in the report to that, which will be published in actually next December. It'll be in place next January. And then we have a number of other recommendations, like actually going back and reevaluating our BORP program, and those will be taking place probably more in the next year to 2 years.
Sounds like a really interesting portfolio of activities. What fascinates me is you connect learning from past earthquakes in your region and far away and building a resilient basis for the future. It's very exciting times. I hope maybe we'll get a chance to call you back in a year or two and check on your progress and learn about some of your other activities. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I'm glad you're with us. Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please encourage your friends to subscribe to our podcast. The Infrastructure Show is recorded in the Reeves Audio Recording Studios in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Jim Reeves, chief engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I.